Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. For the next hour, join us for a listen back at the stories that made news on our VOA Asia program. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. It was a week where the North Koreans launched a new missile with a greatly expanded range.
It looks like they could essentially cover the entire continental United States with it.
The Pope went to Myanmar with hopes of bringing peace to the Rohingya exodus. He faced issues.
The Catholic Church leaders there are telling him, don't even use the word Rohingya, because it's a controversial word with many of the Buddhists in Myanmar.
You will hear the latest on that, along with the reason behind massive protests this past week in the streets of major cities in Pakistan, and much more. It's all ahead on VOA Asia Weekend. North Korea launched an intercontinental ballistic missile this past week. The U.S. Department of Defense confirmed it traveled about 1,000 kilometers Tuesday. A statement by Pentagon spokesman Colonel Robert Manning said the missile did not pose a threat to North America, our territories, or our allies. A U.S. intelligence official told VOA the United States is not surprised by the development. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis commented after briefing President Trump at the White House.
North Korea launched an intercontinental ballistic missile. It went higher, frankly, than any previous shot they've taken. It's a research and development effort on their part to continue building ballistic missiles that could threaten everywhere in the world, basically. And in response, the South Koreans have fired some pinpoint missiles out into the water to make certain North Korea understands that they could be taken under fire by our ally. But the bottom line is it's a continued effort to build a threat, a ballistic missile threat that endangers world peace, regional peace, and certainly the United States.
The North Korean missile was reported to have splashed down in Japanese waters. In Tokyo, the cabinet crisis team was summoned for an emergency meeting. Japan's chief cabinet secretary said Tokyo strongly protested the launch. I spoke with David Wright, the co-director of the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Well, we know that it looks like the kinds of tests North Korea was doing earlier in the year, which was to shoot things on a very, very high lofted trajectory that would come down in the Sea of Japan rather than overflying Japan. If you look at how high it went and figure out how far that would go if you shot it on a normal trajectory, it's very, very long. It looks like they could essentially cover the entire continental United States with it.
So this is a major breakthrough then, is that correct?
Well, it certainly is longer range than we have seen them fire before. We don't know exactly how they did it. One thing to keep in mind is that it seems likely that they launched this with a very light payload as a way of trying to get longer range. And what that means, if true, is it means that it would not be able to carry, say, a nuclear weapon any place close to this kind of range. So there's still a lot of questions about it that we're trying to understand.
You've been studying this North Korean nuclear and missile program for, what, 20 years or so now?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. What does this mean as far as where they are?
Well, again, I think for those of us who have watched the program, it's clear that they've been making progress. It's clear that they have put together a team of engineers who know what they're doing, and they've been able to solve a lot of the technical problems. So I would say this is something of incremental progress in the sense that, we've seen them do long tests before, and this is somewhat longer. We'll have to wait. We expect to see pictures tomorrow and see if there's anything particularly different about the missile. But, you know, what we're seeing and what I've been saying for 20 years is that given time, North Korea will figure this technology out and be able to make more and more capable missiles and warheads.
You're saying given time. How much time?
Well, I was saying 20 years ago we had, some years ahead of us. At this point, it's very hard to know. I mean, it clearly they are at the point where they're making progress toward being able to reach, the United States, targets in the United States with a nuclear warhead. But there are things we just don't know, like how heavy their warheads are at this point, what capability these missiles have if they carried a warhead. So, it may be a year, it may be 2 years, but it's no longer, 5 to 10 years.
Does this in any way change the way, in your mind anyway, the world and specifically the United States should react to this?
Well, I've been saying for a long time that this is a case where trying to sanction North Korea, trying to cut it off, has not been working. That there are no good military options because of the vulnerability of Seoul in particular, even to conventional attacks from North Korea. And that what really needs to happen is beginning of diplomatic negotiations. And I think this makes that even more clear, that they're continuing to make progress. Even if you think sanctions are going to work, they're not going to work as quickly as the missile program seems to be going forward. So I think there's really no other way around it than to try and sit down with North Korea. And even if you can't stop their missile and nuclear program, as much as we'd like to, you would still like to stabilize the situation so that things don't get out of control and there's an attack that nobody means to launch.
And that, as far as you are concerned, is only doable via negotiation.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, when you see the kinds of rhetoric, the kind of back and forth that President Trump and Kim Jong-un have had, you see both sides, making claims, drawing red lines, backing themselves in corners. And those are the kind of situations where some crisis can happen, where people make decisions that they wouldn't make in a normal situation. And that's, I think, the biggest threat right now, is that things might get out of hand under some sort of unexpected situation.
David Wright, the co-director of the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists in Cambridge, Massachusetts. North Korea was claiming that its latest intercontinental ballistic missile that it tested Wednesday is proof that it now has a nuclear weapon that can reach any target in the United States. That said, the statement on North Korean media showed that the country had reached its goal of achieving the greatest historic cause of completing the state nuclear force. Some are saying that could mean that the North might be willing now to resume negotiations. I asked Evans Revere whether he agreed with that possibility. Revere is a former U.S. State Department official specializing in Asia.
Well, before we get to that, I would have to raise some questions about whether North Korea has in fact crossed the finish line in terms of developing the capability to actually strike the United States and targets anywhere in the United States with a nuclear weapon. The test that they conducted was very impressive in terms of its technical capability and the demonstration of this new capacity. And so it certainly has the range on paper to reach a number of targets in the United States, but there still are some serious technical hurdles that the North Koreans have yet to demonstrate that they have reached yet. One of those is whether that missile that was successfully tested yesterday could carry a nuclear warhead that entire distance, since a warhead is pretty heavy, and with the shielding and all of that, that would be one thing that we haven't seen yet demonstrated. But perhaps an even more fundamental thing that they have yet to prove is that they can send a warhead out into space and bring it back through the Earth's atmosphere and have the warhead successfully re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, survive all the forces, the heat and other forces, and then strike a target. So those are two important things that the North Koreans have yet to demonstrate, and I have no doubt that in their next test or tests, and there will be more, they will be testing those capabilities, perhaps successfully. Now, when they do finally cross the finish line, it is entirely possible that they will respond to calls for talks by the United States or even propose them themselves. But if we get to that point, we will find very quickly that the kind of dialogue that the North Koreans are interested in having with the United States is not a dialogue about ending its nuclear program, but a dialogue that involves accepting them as a nuclear weapon state and dealing with them as such permanently. And that will be a very, very uncomfortable and probably unacceptable conversation for the United States.
You have taken part, as I understand it, in negotiations with the North Koreans. What is it that they want? You already said that they want to be a member of the nuclear family in the world, but what about it is, what do they crave most?
Well, I'll tell you what the North Koreans have told me and have told others in some of these conversations. They want to be accepted as a nuclear weapon state. They don't need to be formally acknowledged as such, they have told us. But they want to have their deterrent, and then they want to be able to enter into talks with the United States as one nuclear weapon state with another. Those are their words, and the words of a very, very senior North Korean official who said those things to us in one of our meetings with them. But beyond that, the North Koreans are hoping that once they develop and demonstrate authoritatively and credibly this new capability of being able to strike targets in the United States with a nuclear weapon, they then believe that they can compel the United States to come to the negotiating table and to negotiate with them as an equal a number of things of concern to the North Koreans, including ending the Korean War formally with a peace treaty that would replace the current armistice. Preferably, this would be a bilateral discussion that wouldn't involve the South Koreans, the ROK. And in the North Korean mind, that then leads to the end of the U.S.-South Korean alliance, the end of the U.S. military presence on the Korean Peninsula, the end of the U.S. nuclear umbrella over South Korea, as well as Japan. And this, at the end of the day, opens the door for them to then translate their nuclear monopoly on the Korean Peninsula into their ability to intimidate South Korea and forcibly, or preferably without any force, reunify the Korean Peninsula under Pyongyang.
What does this latest missile test do to at least some reports that there had been movement toward resumed negotiations? I don't know whether you were involved in any of these or not, but nevertheless, where do you think those movements do stand if indeed they did take place?
I have not seen any indications of any movement towards resumed negotiations, quite frankly. I've seen a lot of aspirational statements. I've seen a lot of expressions of hope, particularly on the part of people in the current administration, particularly in the State Department. While there may have been some hopes for a resumption of talks and some hope for signals, et cetera, the reality is that the North Koreans have continued with the development of their nuclear weapons program and missile programs apace. There's been no delay that I've seen.
Former U.S. State Department official Evans Revere. Coming up on VOA Asia Weekend, a journey wrought with diplomatic difficulty for the Pope. Pope Francis called for religious unity in Myanmar in a speech in the country's capital that did not directly mention the plight of the Rohingya. The pontiff told diplomats and members of civil society Tuesday in Naypyidaw that religious difference needs not to be a source of division and distrust, but rather a force for unity, forgiveness, tolerance, and wise nation building. Pope Francis shared a stage with State Councilor Aung San Suu Kyi, who quoted from the Bible in her introductory speech. Meanwhile, as plans to repatriate Rohingya refugees to Myanmar move forward, rights groups and NGOs were raising alarms about security for those returning to the country, which they had recently fled to escape violence. Steve Sanford spoke to human rights and migrant experts about the future that more than 600,000 refugees will be facing.
In Rakhine State, army clearance operations have wiped out hopes for Rohingya Muslim refugees to return home. Rights groups say a repatriation plan between Bangladesh and Myanmar is ill-timed and a maneuver to reduce the growing international condemnation. Refugees say the abuse and mistreatment must end before they feel safe enough to return.
We will go back to Myanmar again only if the Burmese don't torment us and give us the opportunity to live there safely. They don't accept our identity.
A major obstacle for returnees will be citizen verification, as most of those who fled the country had few belongings with them. Bangladesh has issued ID cards to many refugees, but it is unclear what Myanmar officials will require, as the ethnic Rohingya have been officially stateless in the country since 1982. Myanmar has a history of denying rights to its ethnic minorities, including land ownership, says migrant expert Brahm Press.
Part of the strategy by the Burmese military government in the past was to displace people and then replace them with their own nationalities. So that means that the majority Burmans were then moving into areas which were previously ethnic dominated groups.
Children make up 60% of the refugees in the camps, and the psychological damage they experience has yet to be treated.
The majority of kids who have come across are very much affected to what they've been through. And some of them are traumatized, seriously traumatized. We see this by talking to them, by receiving their accounts of what they went through. We look at some of the drawings that they make. Sometimes it's extremely violent. And so they need strong support, and not just now, but for the near future as well.
Even as more Rohingya flee Myanmar and new arrivals fill the camps, those here say the thought of returning to face the horrors they have escaped is still unthinkable. Steve Sanford reporting for VOA News from Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh.
Myanmar's military chief said he told Pope Francis that there is no religious discrimination in his country, where violence against Rohingya Muslims has been termed ethnic cleansing by the United States. Myanmar has no religious discrimination at all, Senior General Ming Aung Hlaing said in a Facebook post by his office. Likewise, he said, our military too performs for the peace and stability of the country. Pope Francis met with Myanmar's military chief Monday as he began his trip to the Southeast Asian country to discuss violence in the Rakhine State, which has caused over 620,000 Rohingya Muslims to flee into neighboring Bangladesh. After the 15-minute meeting, Vatican spokesman Greg Burke had said the two discussed the great responsibility of authorities of the country in this time of transition before they exchanged gifts. The pontiff was greeted by Myanmar clerics as he arrived at the Yangon airport. Catholics make up one of the smallest religious minorities in Myanmar. Nonetheless, crowds lined the streets of Yangon, waving yellow Vatican flags as the Pope's motorcade made its way through the streets. Not all are behind the papal journey to Myanmar. We welcome to VOA Asia Father Thomas Rees. He's a member of the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, and he is senior analyst at the Religion News Service. And we want to stress here that Father Rees is speaking for himself and not for the commission. Father Rees, why do you think the visit of the Pope might not be the best decision here?
He's in a very difficult situation. As you know, the Rohingya Muslims have been treated just abysmally in their country. The United Nations has referred to it as a case study in ethnic cleansing. And so these are the kinds of people that the Pope heart goes out to. In fact, he has spoken in defense of the Rohingya Muslims from Rome. But now that he's going to Myanmar, where this is happening, the Catholic Church leaders there are telling him, don't even use the word Rohingya, because it's a controversial word with many of the Buddhists in Myanmar. So he's caught it between a rock and a hard place. If he speaks out for the Rohingya, the Christians in Myanmar may suffer more persecution than they're already suffering now. On the other hand, if he goes to Myanmar and says nothing about the Rohingya, people are going to be asking, well, why not? Why hasn't he spoken out in defense of these people? So he's been put in a very difficult position.
So what do you think he should have done instead? As you have stressed in the beginning of your statement, was that he feels very, very deeply about this kind of situation and has become involved in the past.
Well, I think he's been speaking out very appropriately from Rome, speaking on behalf of the Rohingya, calling for reconciliation between Muslims, Christians, and Buddhists. That's very important for him to do that. On the other hand, going to Myanmar, I hope he can be a force for reconciliation there. But on the other hand, the Pope's not a miracle worker. Nobody else has been able to solve this problem. But hopefully he can, point a light at the problem, but I hope he can do it in a way that doesn't cause more grief and persecution for the Christians in Myanmar.
Low be it for us to tell the Pope what to do, and I know neither you or me wants to do that, but what do you think would be the best option on how to handle this except for not going?
Well, that's going to be really tough. I think he's going to have to be very careful in the words he uses. He is going to meet with the Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh, and that's very, very important that he be seen and reaching out to them so that the whole world community can see how what dire straits they are in the they hardly have even refugee camps. It's just an awful situation they're living in, and they need the international community to come to their assistance. I think he's got to speak while he's in Myanmar to the government and to the military. Now, whether that's behind closed doors or publicly is a tough call. I think he will speak very clearly to the government of Myanmar and also to the military, who are the real power in Myanmar, this kind of ethnic cleansing and persecution has to stop. But whether he does that publicly or behind closed doors is a judgment call that I would leave to him.
We thank Father Thomas Rees, a member of the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom and the senior analyst at Religion News Service. Father Rees, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to talk to you.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said diplomatic options in response to North Korea's missile launch remain viable and open for now. South Korean President Moon Jae-in warned the situation could spiral out of control if Pyongyang perfects its ICBM technology. China expressed its grave concern, but said a dual freeze on the North's nuclear and missile testing and the U.S.-South Korean military exercises remain the best option. Senior RAND Corporation defense researcher Bruce Bennett told VOA's Victor Beatty outside analysis will have to determine, among other things, the weight of the warhead. He said missiles are sensitive to the payload. If it was just a couple of hundred kilograms, it might not reach most targets with a nuclear warhead. He also spoke about the length of time that elapsed from the last test.
What one has to wonder is, with all of the statements that the U.S. had made in the August and September timeframe, how seriously was Kim Jong-un intimidated by that? Did he really worry that if he continued on his fast pace of activities, that the U.S. might take a military action? Even now, what President Trump is saying, nobody really knows. He might try a military action. But Kim had focused in August and September on the Ulchi Freedom Guardian exercise that the U.S. and South Korean military do in Korea, and was trying to say, I want to go with the Chinese approach of you canceling your exercises and I'll cancel my missile tests. And when the U.S. refused to do that, he then tested several missiles and a nuclear weapon to punish us for not being prepared to compromise. I think after all of that, he probably felt that he'd pushed the U.S. and South Korea as hard as he could for a while, and he'd better back off in order not to get himself into some real trouble.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said he's not giving up on a diplomatic solution to this situation, but is time running out?
The U.S. would clearly prefer a diplomatic solution. The question is, where's Kim Jong-un headed? If his objective is only regime survival, only to protect his regime, he's demonstrated plenty of capability that he could cause us some harm, he probably doesn't need a whole lot more in the way of missile tests. But if his objective is to go to some form of nuclear war fighting where he could seriously threaten the U.S. and South Korea, then he likely would need to continue the testing he's been doing this year. So I would say over the next few months, we're going to have a pretty clear indication of what his objective is.
DefensePriorities.org senior fellow Danny Davis said he believes Kim Jong-un's objective is a defensive nuclear deterrence against U.S. threats, not an offensive capability he knows will only invite a catastrophic military response. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia Weekend. Pakistani Islamists clashed with security forces for a second day last Sunday on the outskirts of Pakistan's capital of Islamabad, burning vehicles before withdrawing to a protest camp they have occupied for more than 2 weeks. Hospital officials said nearly 200 people were hurt, most of them police. I spoke with veteran correspondent Ayaz Ghul, reporting for VOA from Islamabad.
Well, we still have sort of a stalemate prevailing because a police crackdown was launched Saturday morning to disperse these protesters. But because the moment the news of the crackdown went out, the number of protesters started increasing and going up to from several thousand to 10 or 12,000 people. That made the job of the security forces, the police forces primarily, very difficult. And there were then clashes that broke out, resulted in injuries and, in fact, several deaths, prompting the administration of the capital city to halt the operation because apparently the protesters were really determined not to give in and to continue with their with their protests until their demands were met. So we still have them sitting at the main interchange that leads to Islamabad. And as a result of this crackdown, we now have in several cities of Pakistan small protests taking place on main highways near the railway stations and bus stations. So basically bringing intercity traffic to a halt also.
What is the cause of the protest?
Well, these they're demanding. Basically, it started several weeks ago when the parliament approved a new bill. And in that bill, there was a minor change that the parliament introduced, and that was related to the membership oath. You know, when parliamentarians take oaths to become members, there was a minor change that occurred, which the government said was a clerical error. But according to these religious protesters, it amounted to blasphemy. It amounted to insulting Islam. So they started pressurizing the government, and obviously, not only that, the pressure increased out on the street, but from within the parliament, there were right-wing parties and religious parties who condemned this action and forcing the government to reverse that change. And they restored the original clause in its original state. So, but that did not make these protesters happy. They said because it amounted to blasphemy, so whoever was responsible for introducing this change must be exposed, must be brought to justice and penalized. And they have demanded from the outset that the law minister should be punished because it is the responsibility of the law minister to write or remove such clauses. And that is what they have been now primarily demanding, that unless and until the law minister is removed and punished, they will not disperse. Obviously, the protesters, their leaders, have vowed to continue until the entire government steps down. That is the latest demand from these protesters today.
What is the overall effect of these protests on everyday life in the major cities of Pakistan, and do you see any way out of this?
Well, in the last 24 hours, life has almost come to a standstill all over Pakistan because major motorways have been blocked and people cannot travel. Intercity travel has been almost impossible. And that has forced, in fact, administrations in different cities, including Islamabad, to shut down schools and other education institutions for the next 2 days. So, and secondly, it has been very difficult for people to know exactly what has been happening because there has been a complete shutdown of media and social media. The government has just cut all options for people to know what is happening around the country, although just a couple of hours ago, they restored the private television channels who have started a broadcast just like a couple of hours ago. At least people are knowing that what is the latest situation. But again, these broadcasts are being controlled through an executive order. Television stations have been instructed not to show live pictures of these demonstrations. So, frankly speaking, as of this moment, it is very difficult to say what is happening all over the country. When we speak to people, individuals in cities like Karachi, Lahore, people tell us they're stuck. They've gone there like on private visits, on official visits, and they have not been able to come back to Islamabad, or those who are in Islamabad are stuck here for the next few days.
The spillover of violence to the rest of Pakistan forced authorities to suspend the police crackdown and enter into talks with the rally leaders. That agreement called for the immediate removal of Minister Hamid and bound the government to release all detained activists and pay for any damage to public property. Critics have denounced the government for giving in to the demands of the Islamist group, saying it will encourage extremism in the country. The chairman of the Pakistani Senate was outraged at the controversial deal. Raza Rabbani slammed the government for not consulting Parliament on an issue of national importance. In another Pakistan-related story, a Saudi-led Muslim military coalition commanded by a former Pakistan army chief was officially launched Sunday in Riyadh, where defense ministers of the participating nations met for the inaugural meeting. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who is also defense minister of Saudi Arabia, opened the meeting of the Islamic Military Counterterrorism Coalition, also called IMCTC. An official statement explained the pan-Islamic coalition of 41 predominantly Sunni Muslim countries will coordinate and multiply their individual efforts in the global fight against terrorism and violent extremism. The formation of the coalition is not being met with unanimous approval in Pakistan. Joining us is Ayaz Gul, who reports from Pakistan for VOA. Ayaz, what's behind this story?
Well, this is, Saudi Arabia has been trying to put together sort of a coalition, a military coalition of its allied nations. And in 2015, the Saudi leadership announced some initial structure of a coalition it wanted to put together. And they named it differently, but over the last year and a half, after some structure was devised, it has been named now as Islamic Military Counterterrorism Coalition. And the objective of this coalition, according to Saudis, is to basically counter terrorism and violent extremism in Muslim countries from a joint front like the one they launched in Riyadh, where defense ministers of 41 countries who are part of this coalition met for the inaugural session. And that's where this coalition formally was launched. And again, under a lot of skepticism and suspicions about its real objectives.
Well, they are predominantly made up of Sunni Muslim countries, correct? So what is the thought here as to what possibly is really going on?
Well, that very fact that predominantly Sunni Muslim nations are part of this coalition, it has created this controversy, especially in Iran and in other Muslim countries where Shiite Muslims are also in a sizable majority, because Iranian leaders from the outset have been opposing this idea. They believe that this Saudi Arabia, because as we know, Saudi Arabia and these are major rivals in the Middle East, and Iranian leadership believes that Saudi Arabia is trying to increase its political influence in the region through such efforts by creating such a coalition. But at the same time, there's also fear in Tehran that maybe this coalition will be, at the end of the day, used against Iran one way or the other, because the current Saudi leadership, according to Iranians, is really looking at Tehran as a major enemy. And that is why they have been opposing it. And, you know, the reason, not only Iran, but here in Pakistan, there has been a lot of criticism of Islamabad joining this coalition, because Iran shares like nearly 1,000 kilometer border with Pakistan and has traditionally good cultural and political ties with Pakistan. But at the same time, you know, Pakistan also has a very strong relationship with Saudi Arabia. And that is why the criticism here in Pakistan has been that if Pakistan joins one of the parties, like either Saudi Arabia or sides with Iran, it will basically be involving itself in a foreign conflict like whatever is happening in the Middle East. So people have been, critics here have been advising the country not to be part of it. But because of the close relationship with Saudi Arabia, obviously Pakistan agreed a year ago when Saudi Arabia offered to make the chief of this new coalition a former Pakistani army general, General Rahil Sharif. And interestingly, the Pakistan government immediately agreed to it. And General Rahil Sharif, when the coalition was launched in Riyadh, has now formally taken command of this new coalition. But amid fears and concerns here in Pakistan that the Shiite minority community is not happy, and they have demonstrated through statements and through meetings with leadership here that they're not happy because this coalition might be used against Iran, and that is not good for Pakistan, where Shiite and Sunni militant groups have been attacking each other for years.
Ayaz Ghul reporting and talking with us from Islamabad for VOA. And Ayaz, once again, thank you so much. We greatly appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Ahead on VOA Asia Weekend, with nuclear tensions rising, the U.S. state of Hawaii is beefing up its alert system. Stay with us. Pope Francis visited Myanmar and neighboring Bangladesh this past week amid international outrage over what the U.S. described as the ethnic cleansing of Myanmar's Rohingya Muslim minority. During the trip lasting through December 2nd, the Pope met with Myanmar's civilian and military leaders, as well as with Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh. As Jessa Suman Oni reported, all eyes were on the pontiff to see how he handled the diplomatic minefield in Myanmar, also known as Burma.
A message from the Pope to the Burmese people as he prepares to visit their nation.
Desidero inviare una parola di saluto e di amicizia.
I wish to send a word of greetings and friendship to all the people. I look forward to being with you. I come to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ, a reconciliation, peace, and forgiveness message.
The first papal trip ever to Myanmar comes 6 months after full diplomatic ties were forged in May during a visit by the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, who has since come under international pressure over the plight of the Rohingya. More than half of the Rohingya Muslim populations have fled their homes in the Rakhine state after an August attack by Rohingya insurgents sparked a brutal military crackdown. Refugees residing in camps in neighboring Bangladesh accused Myanmar's army of rape, mass murders, and destruction of villages, allegations which the military denies. Experts warn the pontiff is plunging into a diplomatic minefield.
The vast majority of people in Myanmar do not believe the international narrative of abuse against the Rohingya and the refugee numbers that we're seeing in Bangladesh. That is just not accepted as fact here in Myanmar. And so I think if the Pope did come and weigh in heavily on this issue, it would inflame tensions, it would inflame sentiment, public sentiment.
Pope Francis will once again meet with State Councilor Suu Kyi and separately with the head of the country's army. The outspoken Pope has been cautioned not to even use the term Rohingya, as Myanmar does not recognize the ethnic group to be of legitimate status.
If he uses the word Rohingya, some of the Buddhist nationalists might then protest and complain about that. And some of the Catholics in the country are very nervous about that because they fear that they could be targeted by nationalists.
The Pope will also meet with Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh, where hundreds of thousands are sheltering in refugee camps. Myanmar has agreed to take back some of the refugees, so long as they can prove their residency, but the details are still unclear. As Catholics in Myanmar await the head of the church, a prayer that his visit brings peace and divine intervention to ease tensions. Jason Samaoni, VOA News, Washington.
We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia Weekend. Australia's latest blueprint for foreign policy says that greater self-reliance is needed as that country prepares for a world in which the United States retreats and China becomes more powerful and unpredictable. From Sydney, Phil Mercer had the report.
Opportunity, security, strength are the three words on the cover of Australia's latest foreign policy document. The white paper is the first since 2003 and sets out Canberra's global strategy for the next decade. Its blunt assessment is that China is challenging America's position as the dominant force in the Asia-Pacific region. The policy blueprint argues the US will remain crucial to Australia's national security, but says Canberra must build even closer ties to Beijing. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull believes Australia must adapt to an evolving world order.
We are navigating a rapidly changing multipolar world in which each of the major players are testing their relationships with each other while undergoing rapid change themselves. In the past, we could safely assume that the world worked in a way that suited Australia. Now power is shifting and the rules and institutions are under challenge.
The White Paper describes uncertainty in the Asia-Pacific region and calls on the Australian government to build stronger ties with other regional nations, such as India, Indonesia, Japan and South Korea. Turnbull has also stressed that his country must also take greater responsibility for its own security and prosperity. A military alliance with the United States dates back to the early 1950s. Bates Gill, a professor of Asia-Pacific Security Studies at Macquarie University in Sydney, agrees that Australia shouldn't be overly reliant on the US.
Australia must recognise that in this more volatile period, in a period of greater unpredictability as to the continued commitment on the part of the United States to its engagement in this region, it has to look for other options and not be so reliant, as the White Paper notes, on this long-standing and traditional relationship with the United States.
Australia has also raised concerns about the pace and scale of China's activities in the contentious South China Sea, prompting Beijing to insist that Canberra shouldn't get involved in the wide-ranging territorial dispute.
This is VOA Asia Weekend. As tensions escalate between North Korea and the United States, Hawaii finds itself on the front lines in preparing for a nuclear attack. Whether or not North Korea has developed the capability of hitting the islands with a missile, state officials are taking no chances. Heidi Chang has more from Honolulu.
Starting in December, Hawaii will be testing its attack warning siren for the first time since the Cold War in the 1980s. The state is adding the signal to its monthly attention alert test, which warns people of an incoming tsunami or hurricane. While the wailing siren could be used to warn of a nuclear strike from North Korea, Vermiyagi, who's the administrator of the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency, says he thinks an attack is unlikely.
If North Korea launches against us or allies, the retaliation will be complete, and that would defeat North Korea's ambition to continue its regime. So if they did launch an attack against us, their regime would probably end.
Nevertheless, Miyagi's agency is ramping up efforts to educate the state's 1.4 million residents and also visitors on how to prepare for a nuclear attack.
Hawaii is a likely target because we're in the Pacific. We're closer into North Korea than most of the continental United States, so it's something that we need to prepare for. As we track the news and we see the tests, both missile launches and nuclear tests, you know, it's the elephant in the room. We have to consider it. We can't ignore it.
That's why the state has posted guidelines online to prepare people for a nuclear attack. It's also getting the word out through community meetings and public service announcements.
The attack warning signal advises everyone to take immediate shelter. Get inside, stay tuned. To find out more.
World War II veteran Ted Tsukiyama recalls hearing the air raid warning sirens after Japan bombed Pearl Harbor.
Sirens are installed all over the city after the war started. And then, you know, of course, they would test them every now and then. So I remember hearing the sirens go off every now and then. The radio would give us a warning that say, this is only a test and all that. You know, don't get alarmed and all that.
Tsukiyama, who's now in his late 90s, says he isn't surprised the sirens are coming back because Hawaii has long been a defense outpost. It's home to the U.S. Pacific Command, the military's headquarters for the Asia-Pacific region.
I suppose that's necessary as a precaution, but I don't think North Korea is going to try to attack. They'd be foolish to threaten South Korea or Japan or the U.S.
U.S. officials estimate a North Korean missile could reach Hawaii in about 20 minutes. It would take 5 minutes for authorities to determine its target, which would leave about 12 to 15 minutes to warn the public. Despite the state's public outreach and education efforts, Miyagi says there are still misconceptions.
The first one that I've heard is that we shouldn't prepare, we shouldn't plan, because it's never going to happen, so we're wasting our time. The second misconception is that there's no use preparing, no use planning, because if it's a nuclear attack, we're all going to die. But based on what the threat is right now, if there is an impact, you know, there will be many, many, many survivors, 80%, 90% survivors.
So Miyagi encourages everyone to have a plan and know where to shelter in place ahead of time. Officials also recommend having enough food and water to survive for 48 hours and supplies to last up to 14 days, just in case. For VOA News, I'm Heidi Chang in Honolulu.
Having a tattoo is no longer just a symbol of being in a criminal gang. Famous celebrities showing off their inked bodies show tattoos are becoming more mainstream in many cultures, and an increasing number of people see tattoos as an art form. Tattoos have a history that spans thousands of years across many cultures. VOA's Elizabeth Lee visited a new traveling exhibit at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County on the long global history of tattoos.
Chewy Quintanar has been creating art on living canvas for more than 20 years.
When I first started tattooing, it was still looked as a bad thing. But I always saw tattooing as an art form.
When a museum asked him to contribute a piece to the exhibit called Tattoo, he knew tattoo's negative image was changing.
It was it's like a dream to be in a prestigious museum.
This exhibition is one of the very first exhibition on tattoo that come from people from the tattoo culture. All the other ones, there have been a number of them, were put together by doctors or criminologists.
The exhibit shows tattoos from Asia to Africa to the Americas.
It's something that goes across cultures, thousands of years, and it's basically a universal impulse and practice. There's lots of reasons that people may have tattooed in the past and certainly tattoo today, whether it's to mark a rite of passage, to mark a moment in time that's important to them.
This exhibit shows examples of the many reasons why people go through this painful process, from a Congolese tattoo to video of this ritual in Thailand.
Tattoo has a strong spiritual and religious purpose in a lot of cultures, where the tattoos themselves have a power.
A tattoo can be a sign of defiance, shame, or honor.
One of the main use of tattooing was to mark people down and to exclude them and to punish them. A traditional tattoo is a tattoo that you don't choose and you don't decide on. It's a tattoo that your group, your family, your people decide it's time for you to have.
This exhibit not only looks at the history of global tattoos, it also features the colorful tattoo scene in Los Angeles, and guests even have opportunities to get a tattoo here at the museum. The exhibit not only showcases LA's modern tattoo culture, it also shows its history.
The Pike became a place where all the sailors were coming home from Asia, and they were kind of exchanging tattoos that they had received when they were in Asia.
The Pike, a waterfront amusement park off the coast, was a popular place for LA's early tattoo scene. Then the black and gray tattoo style emerged from East Los Angeles, an area that's largely Latino.
The black and gray style, the Chicano style, it's called. And that's the style that I do.
Quintanar says he's wanted to show his art to the world, and now he can. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Remember, you can hear this program on our VOA Asia Facebook page as well as at voanews.com. A Chinese court in Hunan province Tuesday sentenced Taiwan activist Li Mingche to 5 years in prison for subverting state power, a verdict denounced by Taipei as dissatisfying and regretful and demanded his release. Co-defendant Peng Yuha was given a 7-year term. The court stripped them of their political rights for 2 years and said both defendants would not appeal. Their September trial is believed the first under China's new law tightening control over foreign non-governmental organizations. During the trial, Li, who disappeared soon after reaching the mainland in March, confessed to writing and distributing online articles critical of China's ruling Communist Party and promoting multi-party democracy. Roseanne Reif, Amnesty International's East Asia director, spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty about the sentences.
I think it's another case of a human rights defender who works with stakeholders in China talking about issues that the government considers sensitive, and therefore the government is trying everything they can to silence that type of discussion and debate. I think his sentence is clearly preposterous but not unexpected. We have seen this happening to other human rights defenders and activists, and I think this signals that the government is really not going to tolerate any kind of discussion and doesn't want people from outside the mainland to come and have these discussions with stakeholders there.
Roseanne, I understand this is the first trial under China's new law last year, tightening controls over foreign non-governmental organizations.
Well, I think it's important to remember that he was sentenced for the crime of subverting state power, which again is something where we've seen leveled at human rights defenders and activists more frequently. And usually it's for things like having online discussions, basically, you know, using their right to freedom of expression and peaceful activities. I think the foreign NGO law demonstrates that the government is trying to make sure that NGOs are not pushing the limits, trying to limit foreign NGOs from coming in and working with stakeholders in China, moving the oversight of foreign NGOs from civilian affairs to the Public Security Bureau is a clear signal that, you know, this kind of activity is going to be monitored very carefully, and if something seems to be running against government policy, the government will shut it down.
Do we have any idea exactly what he was trying to accomplish when he arrived on the mainland back in March?
No. I mean, I think that we've seen accounts that he was actually there in this particular instance on a more personal trip, but I'm not really sure that matters. The government put him up on these charges of subverting state power for the activity he was carrying on online, the discussions, the work with stakeholders and activists and NGOs in China. That was clearly the activity that caused the problem and caused the trial.
Amnesty's Roseanne Rife said the sentences are meant to stifle Chinese human rights activities and comes amid a crackdown on domestic activists and lawyers that, according to the Washington Post, total more than 200 over the past 2 years. You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. Mount Agung, an active volcano on the Indonesian island of Bali, appears ready to erupt after months of ominous steaming. Indonesia's Disaster Management Agency has upgraded the alert to the highest level after the volcano shifted into what geologists say is the magmatic phase before an eruption. The volcano alert level was raised to its highest level as the mountain spewed thick gray ash thousands of meters into the atmosphere. Bali's international airport was closed Monday, leaving thousands of tourists stranded. The volcano's last major eruption came in 1963, leaving hundreds dead. Agung has experienced more frequent tremors since September. Australian analyst Kevin Evans told VOA from Jakarta that the volcano had been giving troubling signs for some time.
What's interesting is that it had an attempt at blowing up a few months ago and then it cooled down. So it's really having a second go this time. But it's probably the biggest eruption from that island since March 1963.
Is it affecting a lot of people?
Actually, the smoke is blowing more to the east. And so the eastern end of Bali is islands like Lombok, rather than to the west to Java. So the population affected is less than would have been the case if the smoke was blowing to the west.
Indonesian authorities said up to 100,000 people should heed evacuation warnings. About 40,000 actually left an 8 to 10 kilometer exclusion zone near the volcano, although Evans said more are out of harm's way.
Much of the population's already been moved for its own security. So I think we'll wait to see what sort of damage is being created at this level of eruption. It has been relatively quiet, so this is the biggest eruption since that March 1963 eruption, which caused a bit more damage to people. I don't think they had quite the disaster management capacities that they've now developed. Knowing the behavior of volcanoes is a difficult one at best, but for this volcano, it really began blowing to life a couple of months ago. It slowed down a bit, and now it's having a second breather. So no one, I think, really knows exactly just how far it's going to go.
Indonesia has the most active volcanoes of any country in the world. Mount Sinabung on the western island of Sumatra has erupted several times, most recently killing 16 in 2014 and 7 in 2016. The World Health Organization says the significant progress made in recent decades against malaria is at risk. Henry Ridgewell in London told us in its annual report, looking at the global fight against the disease, the WHO said malaria cases are on the rise in several countries.
The World Health Organization highlights that many countries are moving towards eliminating malaria, among them Madagascar, Senegal, and Zimbabwe. But the report warns that in many countries, progress has stalled. There was an increase in malaria cases of more than 20% in 8 African countries from 2015 to 2016, including Rwanda, Nigeria, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. At the same time, funding for malaria prevention and treatment has leveled off, reaching $2.7 billion in 2016, less than half of the 2020 target.
That amount of funding internationally has plateaued. Possibly it's reached the realistic maximum. And it's always been assumed, indeed it's been important, that countries themselves should commit to funding malaria control. And I think the big opportunity now is for those countries to step up and realise that this is good value.
Overall, it is Africa that continues to bear the highest burden of the disease, with approximately 401,000 deaths in 2016, a slight decrease from the previous year. Despite earlier fears, the malaria parasite does not yet appear to be developing drug resistance in the region.
The current treatments within Africa, they work very well. There is resistance in Southeast Asia, which is spread, which is potentially going to be more of a problem in the future. Insecticide resistance has spread much more. That's the resistance in the mosquitoes.
In addition to improving the coverage of existing methods of malaria prevention, the WHO calls for urgent investment in new tools.
More research is needed to develop an effective malaria vaccine that could cover the populations that at the moment have high malaria rates and that perhaps don't use the available interventions even when they are being funded.
Several malaria vaccines are under development. The WHO is planning a major trial of the so-called RTSS vaccine starting next year in Kenya, Ghana and Malawi. But its latest report warns the world is at a crossroads. Without better funding and more effective rollout of tools to tackle malaria, the progress made in recent decades could be undone. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This has been VOA Asia Weekend, a look back at many of the stories we covered this past week on VOA Asia. You can hear that program as well as VOA Asia Weekend at voanews.com as well as on the VOA Asia Facebook page. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Thanks for listening.